Today is Wednesday, August 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up, the UN seeks help for hundreds to stranded refugees.
Really, this is a question of how much we're willing to turn a blind eye to the suffering of people who have fled war and violence.
Also ahead, U.S. lobster fishermen struggle in the face of steep Chinese tariffs. It's all on today's International Edition. Hong Kong's airport is open today after days of protest had shut it down and prompted a sharp police crackdown on the thousands of demonstrators clogging one of the world's busiest air terminals. Most flights were operating normally. The Hong Kong Airport Authority says a judge granted an interim order to limit anti-government protest by restricting demonstrators to designated areas. The protests at the airport are just part of 10 weeks of demonstrations around the Chinese territory. The demonstrators want the government to abandon plans to pass a law allowing extradition to mainland China, and they want the city's leader to step down. Charles de Ledesma with the Associated Press has more.
Protesters have circulated letters online apologizing to travelers for inconveniences during the past 5 days of airport occupations. They're asking for understanding and forgiveness as young people in Hong Kong continue to fight for freedom and democracy. Meanwhile, police say they arrested five people over violence at the city's international airport on Tuesday. A further development is that satellite photos show what appear to be armored personnel carriers belonging to China's paramilitary People's Armed Police parked close to the border with Hong Kong. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Thank you, Charles. My colleague Ira Melman spoke with reporter Aaron Hale in Hong Kong about the protest, the clashes with police, and any possible intervention by Beijing. She says the court injunction will affect the protest at the airport.
Well, that now means that the police do have grounds to enter and remove people. So that's a pretty big warning to the protesters. I initially thought, right, police might come back tonight. A lot of people say no. There's still a lot of passengers in the airport. Most of the protesters have left, but it looks like a lot of flights are still coming in right now.
How dangerous is this? I mean, you've been in Hong Kong for a while now. Have you ever seen anything like this before?
I mean, this is, I think we're in unknown territory. I was here during the umbrella movement, and that had some violent skirmishes, but that was pretty peaceful. This is something entirely, especially on Sunday, with police really getting increasingly angry and just violent with protesters and very quick to draw sort of unrestrained force. I think they're kind of going past what their guidelines are. You know, they fired at protesters when they clearly weren't being threatened. And so it's really getting quite intense here.
What is the overall feeling in Hong Kong? Is there great support for the protest, or is that switching as you can see it?
I think a lot of people don't support all the tactics of the protesters, and they'll be very quick to say that, especially when they throw bricks at police officers and they throw, you know, they've lit stuff on fire by them. But overall, I think the public has actually turned against the police because they've seen, you know, their children getting hurt, they're seeing their grandchildren getting hurt. I think, you know, violence from police officers is not something that people really expect en masse in Hong Kong, and this has really come to shock people.
Do you see any way out?
Unless, you know, Carrie Lam, actually, the leader, actually, you know, meets one or two of their demands, like withdrawing the bill permanently. And I think starting an independent commission into police violence would really go a long way. But the police unions apparently are blocking that. So as far as I can see, there is really no way out except for people get really tired and, you know, maybe then they go back to school. It's kind of like a war of attrition right now.
And what has this done to Hong Kong in your mind? Hong Kong has been known as being peaceful, being successful, a great place for business. What has this done?
I think it's really changed what people think of the city. You know, we've seen unprecedented levels of violence. The UN issued a statement today about police tactics and brutality. And, you know, its reputation is as one of the most stable cities in Asia and as a financial hub, and I think that is probably permanently changed. I think a lot of people are actually impressed with the protesters and how organized they are, but everyone's very worried that we could see, you know, 1989 again.
What's the other side of the story, if there is one? Have you considered that? Is there support for Carrie Lam? Is there support for Beijing?
Certainly in the business community, there is support for both Beijing and for Carrie Lam. Whether or not they've been pushed that way to say that is uncertain, but I would say that probably wealthier sectors of Hong Kong society are unhappy with this, and they just want to kind of get on with big business. And there's probably a lot of ordinary people as well who, you know, think these kids are annoying and should just go home.
Ira Melman speaking with reporter Aaron Hale in Hong Kong. Among the top stories in the world, Pakistan celebrates Independence Day as tensions rise with India over Kashmir. U.S. rapper A$AP Rocky is convicted of assault in Sweden. The warden at New York jail, where financier Jeffrey Epstein has died, has been removed from his position. Investigators say Argentine soccer player Emiliano Sala and his pilot were exposed to high levels of carbon monoxide before their plane crashed, killing both of them. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. The UN Refugee Agency warns that time is running out for more than 500 migrants stranded in the Mediterranean Sea as storm clouds gather and their rescue vessels are denied a safe port of entry in Europe. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Italy and Malta continue to refuse docking rights to two rescue vessels. This despite the deteriorating conditions for 356 refugees and migrants rescued August 9th by the Ocean Viking, a vessel run by the charity Doctors Without Borders, and another 151 people who have been on board the Spanish NGO Open Arms for nearly 2 weeks. UN Refugee Agency spokesman Charlie Yaxley says the passengers are in urgent need of disembarkation. He tells VOA storms are coming, so time is running out for a solution to be found.
The rough seas are expected to intensify during the course of today and into tomorrow. This is a question of how much we're willing to turn a blind eye to the suffering of people who have fled war and violence.
Yaxley says many of the people aboard the rescue vessels come from Somalia, Eritrea, Sudan, and other unstable countries. While many others have fled economic hardship rather than conflict, he says they too have suffered appalling abuse, many during their perilous journeys toward Europe and many more in Libya. He says conditions for refugees and migrants are so abysmal that those rescued at sea should not be returned to Libya, which is not safe.
People don't choose to risk their lives on these dangerous journeys unless they feel the desperation that their lives are in better hands on the water than on remaining on the land. The intensifying fighting, the widespread reports of abuses, including arbitrary detention, means it cannot be considered to have a safe port. Nobody should be returned there.
Yaxley says the UNHCR supports a system whereby European nations share the responsibility of hosting the refugees and migrants with the countries that provide a safe haven to those rescued at sea. However, anti-immigrant governments in Italy and Malta accuse Europe of leaving them to deal with the refugee crisis on their own. To deter rescues at sea, Italy recently passed a law imposing fines of more than $1 million on boats conducting these missions entering its waters. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, since the fall of Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika, Army Chief Ahmed Gayed Salah has often repeated his commitment to dialogue. However, he recently reiterated his call for a presidential election to be held as soon as possible. He hinted that no compromise should be expected from the military. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with William Lawrence, professor of political science at George Washington University, about the challenges in the effort to end the political crisis in Algeria and what the military warnings could lead to.
It will probably lead to nothing in the immediate term. We've already had a presidential election scheduled for April 2019, postponed to July 2019 and then postponed again indefinitely. So he's calling for elections immediately that were impossible to hold both in April and in July, and the reasons that made them impossible to hold haven't changed. So it won't be until they solve the underlying problems that they'll be able to hold such an election.
The interim president, Abdelkader bin Salah, accepted the prerequisites for the proposed political dialogue set by the mediation panel. However, General Qaid Salah warned that releasing those mistakenly called prisoners of conscience is a poisoned idea, accusing the prisoners of attacking state symbols and institutions and insulting the national emblem. What do you make of that?
In Algeria, the military is still sacrosanct, and along with the revolution, it's held in higher regard than anything else. And that continues to be a problem, because you can't really have a functional democracy, and you can't really have a forward progress toward an inclusive political system if you can't even criticize one of the elements of that system. I think it's also important to point out, in answer to both questions, that the army is trying to preserve a system under a constitution that the general public says invalid. So, and the population keeps talking about rule of law, while the military talks about rule of the constitution. And therein lies the problem. It won't be until you have significant constitutional reform that you'll be able to hold an election and you'll be able to criticize the military, which is a sine qua non of this revolutionary movement.
The interim president also said the state, with all its components, including the military, will not be part of the dialogue and will observe the strictest neutrality toward this dialogue. However, the warnings of the Army Chief of Staff only confirm that the military is unwilling to compromise. Would that mean the dialogue initiative is eventually doomed?
Yes, it's doomed for the short term. Because, again, if you hold the military above everything, but then you make the military not subject to civilian control, you've got an impasse. And so a dialogue framed on those terms, whereby the military is not only not participating, but immune from the process, is a non-starter for a population that wants to have the senior ranks of the military changed, along with the senior ranks of the political system. That doesn't mean all dialogues are doomed, and there's a number of dialogue initiatives which have shown some progress, including the one that the president has been involved in, and he has conceded some of the to some of the demands of those involved in the process. So I'm optimistic about dialogue over the longer term, as long as the military does stay out of politics.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at George Washington University. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A weight loss plan called the ketogenic or keto diet has become quite popular over the past couple of years. The keto diet restricts the amount of carbohydrates consumed to no more than around 50 grams a day, which reduces the amount of glucose or sugar in the bloodstream. While the keto diet has been credited with not only weight loss, it also helps diabetics manage their disease. A new study from scientists at the University of Texas at Dallas suggests that restricting blood glucose levels might also keep certain cancers in check. Experimenting on mice with lung cancer, researchers fed them a keto diet and a diabetes drug that prevents glucose in the blood from becoming reabsorbed by the kidneys. The researchers say they found that while this regimen didn't shrink tumors, it did keep them from progressing. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, historically black colleges and universities in the United States have also educated prominent Africans, like the founding presidents of Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. The role of historically black colleges and universities on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Well, a year ago, China imposed tariffs on many American goods and products, including highly coveted Maine lobsters. In just 1 year, export sales of the tasty crustaceans plummeted by more than 80%, forcing American companies exporting to China to make drastic changes. VOA's Julie Chabo traveled to the northeastern state of Maine to learn firsthand about the economic impact of Chinese tariffs on the industry.
Tom Martin has been a lobsterman for 35 years.
I started lobstering as a summer job as a kid when I was 14, and then lobstered every summer until I went to college for about a year and then dropped out and started lobstering year-round.
He says he enjoys what he does, despite the hard work.
Some years you catch a lot of lobsters, some years you don't, but you just work as hard as you can and then let the chips fall where they may.
Lobstermen sell their catch to local wholesalers and restaurants, like Luke's Lobster in Portland Harbor, which serves about 60 whole lobsters a day.
It's fresh, tasty, and the price is really good.
But wholesalers like Sheila Adams of Maine Coast, who export live lobsters to overseas markets, have not been so lucky. In July of 2018, China imposed retaliatory tariffs on U.S. food and agricultural exports, which included live lobsters. Adams saw her business drop by 20% overnight.
About 80% of our sales into mainland China have gone away.
That's because the 25% tariff has to be paid by their Chinese customers, who looked to Canada as an alternative source for their live lobsters. So Adams and her team had to look to other markets, both domestically and overseas, to make up the difference. Today, as fresh live lobsters arrive at their facility, they are processed, packaged, and prepared for shipping to 29 other countries.
It takes all of those other countries combined to equal one market in mainland China. So we had to put a tremendous amount of effort across many, many markets to try to recoup the lost business in China.
Wade Merritt is president of the Maine International Trade Center and director of international trade for the state of Maine. He says Maine Coast is a good example of the impact of the tariffs on the industry.
Exports of live lobster to China from Maine, comparing between 2018 and 2019, they're down 82%. So it has had a significant impact on that industry.
And this has had a severe trickle-down effect.
Think about the corner store or the gas station or the schools or the anything in any of these communities that is a major lobster fishing port. If they're not fishing lobsters, then there is a real problem for those other businesses too.
He encourages companies to diversify and also continue nurturing existing relationships. Advice Sheila Adams agrees with.
Our relationships with our customers in China are really important to us. They've become good friends of ours, and they look forward to the day when the tariff situation resolves and that we can go back to doing business together, let the free market economy come back to being, and let trade happen.
And that will be good news for all who have made lobsters a focus of their daily lives. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Portland, Maine.
Well, U.S. and world stock markets are weakening today after an economic alarm bell has sounded with a warning of a possible recession ahead. The latest indicator comes as world trade slows, Germany shows signs of an economic slowdown, and China's industrial output falls. Sagar Magani with the Associated Press has more.
It's called a yield curve inversion, a market phenomenon showing yields on 2- and 10-year Treasury notes inverted early today. That means investors want more in return for short-term government bonds than for long-term ones. It's a significant indicator investors have lost faith in the economy's soundness. Inversions like this have preceded the last 9 recessions going back to 1955. But Bankrate.com's Mark Hamrick says don't panic.
There's no reason for anyone to lose any sleep or buy canned goods,
saying the economy will not grow forever. It's just a question of when a downturn arrives.
And that could easily be more than a year off.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Well, a diplomatic rift in the Middle East is deepening with Qatar and Turkey on one side and Saudi Arabia, other Arab Gulf states, along with Egypt on the other. Divisions have been growing over how to contain Iran's widening sphere in the region and the latest crisis on Gulf waterways, as well as the ongoing conflict in Syria and disputes over support of the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas. Jordan, a key U.S. ally, is trying to put some distance from its longtime Gulf Arab partners by getting closer to Qatar and Turkey and setting itself in the middle ground. For VOA, Dale Gaflack reports from Amman, Jordan.
Jordan's King Abdullah II is charting a more independent foreign policy course than in the past, analysts say, by taking some distance from the Desert Kingdom's longtime Gulf Arab partners. Jordan recently restored full diplomatic ties with Qatar by naming an ambassador to the country for the first time in 2 years, with Qatar following suit. The development comes more than 2 years after Jordan downgraded its diplomatic representation, a few days after Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Bahrain, often known as the Arab Quartet, cut diplomatic ties with Qatar, accusing it of supporting Islamist militants and meddling in their internal affairs. Jordanian political analyst Osama El-Sharif explains.
Jordan is realigning its foreign policy, and the king is sending a statement that he does not wish, nor does he want to be part of any axis or coalition in the region, except the coalition to fight ISIS. But other than that, Jordan has not joined the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. It has taken steps to restore full diplomatic relations with Qatar because it does not want to be part of an anti-Qatar coalition.
Jordan is also strengthening ties with Turkey after being wary of its growing clout in the Arab world. Turkey has been building up its influence as a major Sunni Muslim power player to compete with regional heavyweight Saudi Arabia in the Middle East, much in the same vein as Shiite Iran has jostled for control by using proxies in regional conflicts. Analysts say Jordan's warming of relations with Qatar and Turkey, who are key rivals of Saudi Arabia, signals a turnaround in Jordan's foreign policy, known to support Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates on most regional and inter-Arab conflicts. But they say that Gulf Arab states have not fulfilled pledges to help bolster Jordan with billions of dollars in a bid to soften the impact of International Monetary Fund austerity reforms on its cash-strapped economy. And their shift in foreign policy focus on Iran, along with Washington, leaves Jordan worried whether a future Palestinian state will be set up under any Middle East peace deal. Despite Jordan's King Abdullah II's first warning in 2004 about the spread of Iran's growing influence in Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, dubbed the Shiite Crescent, analyst El-Sharif says Jordan doesn't have the appetite to get involved in the growing rift with Iran over the Gulf waterways.
Even with regard to Iran, it has been very careful in choosing what kind of actions to take. When Saudi Arabia called for countries to withdraw or close their embassies, Jordan recalled the ambassador but kept the Iranian ambassador in Amman and did not close its embassy. So Jordan is trying to underline the fact that it has its own interests to care for in the region and it does not want to be sucked into some sort of an axis fighting another axis.
The real bone of contention between Saudi Arabia and other Gulf Arab states, along with Egypt on the one hand and Qatar and Turkey on the other, is Iran, says Gunter Meyer, who directs the Center for Research in the Arab World at Germany's University of Mainz. Qatar maintains a loose military cooperation with Iran, and both countries jointly operate a gas field in the Gulf. Although Qatar tries to serve as a mediator, Meyer says, the Saudis do not find this acceptable. He adds that the rift is also playing out in Libya. There, Egypt and Saudi Arabia are backing Libyan military commander Khalifa Haftar, while Qatar and Turkey support the government in Tripoli. Dale Gaflack for VOA News, Amman.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Rob McLean. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
This is Yehiyas Wahib, and here is what's coming up on Africa News tonight. Two car bombs strike a military base in Somalia. And in Nigeria, President Muhammadu Buhari wants to limit food imports. Join us at 1600 UTC for these stories and all the latest developments right here on VOA Africa.